You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony,
I've always had a weird negative knee-jerk reaction to the word compersion. It's a perfectly useful word. It's just that some people dislike certain words. Like some people don't like the word moist, drives some people crazy. I think it's kind of similar to the way some people dislike certain spices. Lots of people hate cilantro. They don't want that shit in their mouths. I don't want compersion in my ears. Okay, Encyclopedia Britannica, I get it. People who dislike cilantro have, quote, a variation in a group of olfactory receptor genes that allows them to strongly perceive the soapy flavored aldehydes in cilantro leaves. Cilantro hate is genetic. I get it. But I don't think anyone has looked into whether there's a genetic reason why some people hate the word moist or nipple or panties or compersion. So a genetic cause for this phenomenon can't be ruled out. But as a fan of the English language, I got to admit, compersion, it's a useful word. You may have heard compersion described as the opposite of jealousy, but when broadly defined, an empathetic state of happiness or joy experienced when another individual experiences happiness or joy, it's really more accurate to describe compersion as the opposite of Schadenfreude. Compersion, happiness at the happiness of others. Schadenfreude, happiness at the misfortune of others. It's a German word. The French gave us ménage à trois and tongue kissing. The Germans gave us Schadenfreude and sauerkraut. Not suggesting we make any inferences about national character here, but it is kind of hard to resist. Now, when polyamorous people use compersion, and it may have been a polyamorous person who first coined the term, it was certainly polyamorous people who popularized it. When polyamorous people use the term, it does mean the opposite of jealousy. It's the feeling of joy you get when your romantic partner finds joy in another romantic partner. Been there, felt that. It's a good feeling, needed its own word. Just wish they'd come up with something that didn't sound like cilantro tastes. Anyway, I've been thinking we may need a third definition of compersion, a sort of post-COVID-19 pandemic definition of compersion, specifically about the joy we introverts are going to feel when all you extroverts we've been locked up at home with for the last year and change can leave the fucking house again. I am an introvert. Staying home, for me, was easy. It's going out for me that's always been hard. And I want all the extroverts out there to know, once you guys can go out again, that includes you, Terry, I'm going to feel a new and different kind of compersion. I am going to take joy in the joy you take going out, but I'm going to enjoy that joy of mine at home. Because I don't want to talk to people in bars or shake hands or, God forbid, have to hug a stranger. Or at least I thought I didn't, but after reading Markham Hyde's piece in the New York Times over the weekend about germs and bacteria and how being exposed to other people's germs and bacteria is good for us, I don't know. In his piece in the opinion section, Can We Learn to Live with Germs Again?, Hyde argues that our health may depend on returning to lifestyles, his term, lifestyles, that regularly exposed us to other people's bacteria, their microbiome. Shaking hands, hugging, licking doorknobs, our microbiomes, the trillions of bacteria living in our guts and all over our skin and in our lungs and our joints and maybe even our brains, their health and our health may depend on constant exposure and re-exposure to other people's microbiomes, which means we're going to have to stop wiping everything down, stop overusing antibiotics and start touching strangers again. Introverts like me, introverts who are lucky enough to live with extroverts, we can count on our extroverts to head out there into the world and to bring home the microbes we need to stay healthy. But to be on the safe side, once we're all vaccinated, if we can get there, once we're on the other side of COVID-19, some of us are going to have to err on the side of rimming total strangers in dark and crowded bars again. That was my takeaway from Markham Hyde's piece in the New York Times. Read it yourself. draw your own conclusions. All right, coming up on today's show, I speak with Anna Sale from the Death, Sex, and Money podcast. We talk about her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things, and then we talked about hard things together. The first part of the interview is on the Micro Savage Lovecast, and then Anna stuck around to answer some listener questions with me. That's on the Magnum, which you can subscribe to at www.savagelovecast.com. Tons of your Q's, lots of my A's, and the amazing Anna Sale. All that coming up today on the Savage Lovecast. This episode is brought to you by Tushy, the modern bidet attachment that your butt will love and everyone who loves your butt will love too. Visit www.hellotushy.com for 10% off your entire order when you use the promo code SAVAGE. Stop wiping and start washing. This episode is brought to you by Helix Sleep, the best mattress for your individualized comfort. Right now, my listeners get up to $200 off all mattress orders at helixsleep.com/savage. Support for today's show, support we are very grateful for, comes from Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can access all the amazing services of the post office right from your desk in your own home, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Just click, print, mail, and you are done. It could not be easier. And right now, use Savage for this special offer. Includes up to $55 worth of free postage, a digital scale, and a 4-week trial. Do not wait. Go to stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Savage. That's stamps.com. Enter S-A-V-A-G-E.
Hi, Dan. So I'm pansexual, and I've told my boyfriend this, but he still thinks that we can have a committed marriage. I think that we could do it. I just wouldn't have any relations with anyone other than my husband. Do you think that's plausible? Do you think that could work? Do you think that we could have kids in a plain old marriage where we're just having sex with each other?
Of course it's possible for someone who's pansexual or bisexual to make and honor a monogamous commitment and to be content and happy in that relationship. There are people out there who will tell you that it is biphobic or panphobic to suggest otherwise. I happen to agree with those people. And yet, I frequently get calls and I frequently get letters and see stuff floating around the internet and in other people's columns from people who identify as pan or bi, who posit that it is somehow erasing their pansexuality or their bisexuality or negating it or frustrating it if their monosexual partner demands or expects them to make and honor a monogamous commitment. Seems like we have to pick one of those two things. And you know which one I've picked. I picked the former. We have to pick one of those two things. Pan people and bi people can make and honor monogamous commitments, and it's biphobic to suggest or panphobic to suggest otherwise and be perfectly content in sexually exclusive relationships with partners of just one gender. Or pan and bi people need to be allowed to express their pansexuality and bisexuality with other partners and therefore can't make and shouldn't be expected to make monogamous commitments. And it would be oppressive to impose a monogamous commitment or expectation on someone who's bi or pan. Got to pick one. Seems like you're in the latter camp, caller. You wouldn't be calling if you didn't feel on some level that what you're potential future husband and father of your children-to-be is suggesting wasn't a problem, wasn't impressive, didn't honor or allow you to be the bi or pan person you are. And it may be that you're the kind of bi or pan person who needs to have other partners and shouldn't be making a monogamous commitment. But, you know, that's not a cross that bi and pan people have to bear all by themselves. Monosexuals, heterosexuals, and homosexuals, we want to fuck other people too. It's not just about gender, this desire for other partners. I can understand why somebody who's bi might be particularly frustrated when they can't be with somebody of the opposite or same sex, depending on who they're in a committed, exclusive relationship with. But that said, experiencing monogamy as a struggle or a sacrifice is so common as to almost be universal. Can you do it? Yes, you can. Will you be happy and content with that choice at all times? No, you won't. But that's true of people who are in open relationships and closed relationships. They're all struggles. You have to ask yourself if this struggle is worth it. If this is a price of admission that your husband-to-be insists you pay to be with him, can you pay it and be content? And if the answer is no, then you're going to have to counter his demand with a demand of your own. That if he wants to be with you, you have to be allowed to express who you are sexually in a way that feels authentic and in a way that will make you feel fulfilled. And for you, not for all bi or pan people, but for you, that means you have to be free to have sex with other people. And if he can't allow for that, you won't be content. And if you're not content, you will sabotage the relationship. He wants monogamy, you don't. And if you can't be content, well, then you're just not sexually compatible. And you know that now. You know that before you've made a commitment or gotten married or scrambled your DNA together. And so you need to resolve this now. You need to come to terms about this now. It doesn't mean over the long life of a relationship you can't renegotiate terms. Most open relationships were closed once upon a time. The existence of all those open relationships proves that these things can be renegotiated and a relationship can survive. But at least going in, at least for the first decade and change, who knows how long, you're going to have to come to an agreement. And if you can't, don't marry this motherfucker. This episode of the Savage Love Cast is brought to you by Helix Sleep. Helix is the sex mattress. Did you know that? They take pride in designing their mattresses with sex in mind. Comfy and saliently sturdy. That's why Terry and I are delighted. Well, it's one of the reasons. One of the most important reasons, we are delighted with our Helix mattress. Helix Sleep has a quiz that takes just 2 minutes to complete and matches your body type and your sleep preferences to the perfect mattress for you. Terry and I matched with the Lux Midnight mattress because we wanted something that felt not too soft, but not too firm either. And we both move around at night, even when we are sleeping. With Helix, you get a mattress that you know will be perfect for the way you sleep and the way you sex. They have several different mattress models to choose from, soft, medium, and firm mattresses. Mattress is great for cooling you down if you sleep hot, and even a Helix Plus mattress for plus-sized folks. So if you are looking for a mattress, you can take the quiz, you order the mattress that you're matched to, and the mattress comes right to your door, shipped for free. You don't ever need to go to a mattress store again. Just go to helixsleep.com/savage, take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life and be there for you when you want to use it for something other than sleeping. They have a 10-year warranty, and you get to try it out for 100 nights risk-free. They'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it, but you're going to love it. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free great and amazing, I use one every night, pillows for our listeners at helixsleep.com/savage. That's helixsleep.com/savage for $200 off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows. helixsleep.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. Big fan. I'm 25. I live on the East Coast. I have been dating my boyfriend for about a year. He's amazing. Our relationship is great. I love him. The thing is that 6 months ago, in the middle of the pandemic, he got laid off. It's been awful for him, and he's taken it really hard to be unemployed. He's lucky that he can do some consulting work, so it's not a financial issue, but it's more the emotional distress of being unemployed. We've only been together for a year, and we're young, so it's not a situation where I'm worried about our joint financials. It's more that I don't know how to support him emotionally through something that feels so out of control to him. It really gets him down. It makes him feel inadequate. And I kind of don't know what to say. The first few months, I would just tell him that I thought that he was amazing and someone was going to realize it soon and he was going to get a job right around the corner. But the more it drags on, the more those things feel like empty words, and I kind of feel at a loss of how to support him. Sometimes I even find myself not talking about my job because I don't want him to feel inadequate, and I know that's not good. So anyone who's been through this, I would love the help. It's not the same as, you know, when your spouse gets unemployed, because I think that then you're connected financially, and so it's a group thing you're going through. This is really something that's happening to him, and I don't know what to do.
Honor his feelings, let him feel his feelings, and then do what you can to distract him. Make dinners, go for bike rides, go do something, have a lot of sex, do something that he feels adequate at. Hopefully he feels adequate when you guys have sex. Be a distraction to him. But you don't want to tell him he can't feel that way or shouldn't feel that way. You don't want to argue with him about what he's feeling right now. And he's feeling what a lot of people are feeling right now. A lot of people lost work in the last year. A lot of people are looking for work now. The jobs are coming back. The economy is coming back. That's great. Those jobs are going to be there. He will find employment. And nobody in the future, no employer is going to look at someone who had a period of unemployment during the pandemic and think any less of them as a potential hire. I'm sure you've said all these things to your boyfriend. The problem can be when we're reassuring someone that, you know, we tell them they shouldn't feel so bad, or they should feel better. We want them to feel better. We try to help them put it into perspective, and they feel no better about that thing. The trap I think of someone in your position can get in with a partner who's feeling bad about being unemployed or anything else is you offer reassurances and they don't seem reassured, and you feel like you failed as a partner. When actually the only thing that's going to, in the long run, make your partner feel better about this is finding a job. In the short run, knowing that he has somebody who's there for him, who wants him to feel better, who's encouraging him to feel better, who's providing him with distractions that make him feel better in the moment, that matters. But there can be a disconnect because you're saying these things in hopes that he'll start to feel better. He doesn't seem to feel any better, and you get frustrated because you aren't able to help him when actually you are helping him by saying those things, but also just by listening to him when he expresses his frustration and his anxiety about this period of unemployment. He's got to feel his feelings. Let him feel his feelings. We all got to feel our feelings. You know what we don't want to do? We want to grope our feelings. We don't want to assault our feelings. So give him some time and space to feel his feelings, and then encourage him to think about something else, to do something else, to feel something else by giving him distractions. And don't roll everything out that you want to do with him as a distraction. Let's do this to take your mind off that. Just initiate the doing of this, the doing of that, and it will be a distraction. You don't want him to think everything that you suggest doing together is about the unemployment or about trying to make him feel better when he doesn't and probably won't feel better about this until he gets a job, until he feels like he's back on his feet again. I hope you don't mind if I talk about shit on the podcast for just a second. It's certainly come up before when we've been discussing anal sex. I'd like to discuss it now in reference to my tushy bidet and when I basically got religion about owning a bidet, about having a tushy bidet on every toilet in my house. Here's the experiment that you might want to run. Get a tushy bidet, take a shit, flush the toilet, and then use the bidet, use the spray, and stand up and look at the water, and you will see all of the extra poop, the bidet, knocked off your ass. That is the shit that when you use toilet paper only and not a bidet first and then a little bit of toilet paper, that's the shit that you were smearing all around your asshole. Yeah, the toilet paper got a lot of it, got most of it, maybe 80% of it, but at least 20% of it you were just smearing around. Now it's gone. Now your asshole is really clean and you use that one little piece of toilet paper and there's nothing on it. That's how I got religion about tushy bidets. So if you have not yet ordered a tushy bidet, order a tushy bidet, run that experiment, and you will feel good about owning a bidet. It's just better than toilet paper. You'll feel cleaner and you'll know it. The brand new Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is stylish. It's eco-friendly. It's easy to install and it makes the best case for itself. And it's really affordable. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself before and after it's used with the Smart Spray automatic self-cleaning nozzle. A Tushy bidet attaches to your existing toilet. It requires no electricity or additional plumbing, and it cuts your toilet paper use by 80%. So the Hello Tushy bidet pays for itself in a few months. Because with Hello Tushy, you barely have to wipe at all. Just poop, spray, dry with a little toilet paper, and on you go. Sanitation is simple. The Schmutz Shield offers easy cleaning, and the knobs are naturally antimicrobial. Already got a tushy bidet on your pot? Upgrade now to the 3.0 model. If you're new to the revolution, join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers who have cleaner butts. Join them right now, save money on toilet paper, and get a clean butt after every flush. Go to hellotushy.com/savage to get 10% off your order and free shipping now.
Hey Dan, heterosexual female here. I'm 37 from the West Coast. I'm pregnant. And I was incredibly happy about it. My partner and I have been wanting to have a kid for a while. And I was over the moon until I found out that I'm having a boy. And I know it's stupid to feel disappointed and to feel like I'm no longer connected to this pregnancy or something. Because my entire life, I saw myself being a mother to a little girl. I don't think I ever imagined having a boy. Not really. Of course, it has to do with family. My mother always wanted me to have a little girl, and she always talked. My brother has boys, and she always talked about how I was going to have her girl. But it really isn't about familial pressure, I don't think. I think I'm just discovering something about myself that's so horrible that I fundamentally, even though I'm in love with a man, and there's men I admire like you, I fundamentally don't like them, which sounds so silly. Like, I hear myself talk and, I understand that gender is a construct. It's so stupid to be so attached to the genitals of a future baby, but I can't help it. I keep crying and crying and feeling like I lost my little girl that I never had. And I'm older. I'm 37. This may be the only child I ever have. And I don't want to feel like I'm going to resent this innocent little baby for not being what I imagined him to be. And everybody keeps telling me, you can have a little girl later, or little boys are the best. You love them. And I feel like, I hope I will love him because he's my son. I feel like obviously I will, but I can't help this feeling of just deep sorrow and disappointment that I'm not going to have a little girl. And everything that I imagined this boy to be, I'm like, if he likes trucks and motorcycles, I'm going to like hate that. And, everything feels exhausting where I'm like, oh, if my little girl liked trucks and motorcycles, that would be cool. Which is, again, so incredibly unfair and stupid. And I know everything I'm saying is irrational and silly. I know that, but I can't feel it. So I guess, how do you get rid of a feeling is what I'm asking. How do I reconcile myself with the idea of maybe having a different type of motherhood that I never imagined I would have, and just being as happy about that as I was before I heard this news?
Listening to your call reminded me of the diary my mom kept when she was pregnant with me. She had four kids. She kept a diary each time she was pregnant and then gave those diaries to us when we were adults. And it's a wonderful thing to have. What's funny about the diary my mother kept while she was pregnant with me is that she was absolutely, utterly convinced throughout that pregnancy that I was going to be a girl. She'd had two boys already. She wanted a girl. She believed deep in her gut that I was kicking that I was a girl. And then I turned out to be a boy. And then my mother got pregnant again and had my sister. So she finally had her girl. So my mom really wanted a girl. And I guess there may have been an instant after I was born, after the delivery, where she was disappointed to learn, I'm so old that you didn't learn these things in advance then, that she hadn't this time had a girl. Three boys in a row. I imagine there was a moment's disappointment, because it's really clear from that diary that she was very invested in finally having a girl and me being a girl and convinced I was a girl. I never felt that from my mother. I never felt that she was in any way upset with me for being a boy, unhappy that I was a boy. I only ever felt complete and unconditional love. And she writes in that diary about when she first held me. I was born a week before her birthday, and she took me home on her birthday. And, she always called me the best birthday present that she ever got. I trust that you will fall in love with your child when your son is born and you first hold your son. These feelings you're having now, what you're grieving now, it will evaporate. And then by the time your son is 2 or 3 years old and picks up the truck instead of the doll, which your son almost invariably will, because as much as we like to say, gender is a construct, anyone who's raised kids, raised boys, raised girls, put gender-neutral stuff in front of them, or trucks in front of the girls and dolls in front of the boys, and then watch those boys and girls swap toys, knows that, yeah, a lot of gender is performance, a lot of gender is a construct, but not all of it. and you can't control for it. You have to let your kid be who your kid is going to be. You have no other choice. And you're going to love that boy that you fell in love with the moment he was born. You're going to love that boy when he plays with trucks. You're going to love that boy when he bites his sandwich into the shape of a gun and fires his peanut butter and jelly Uzi at his best friend. You're still going to love that boy. And you have to just trust that. Just believe that. Might be helpful to speak with a therapist or a shrink. I don't necessarily think you need to, though. I think this is really common. A lot of people get invested in their kids being one gender or the other, one sex or the other sex. A lot of people process what you're processing now, where the dad who wanted the boy has to grieve the boy he's not going to have and instantly falls in love with the daughter that he does. This is so common as to be a cliche. And it's not just dads who have that feeling of being invested in having a child of their sex. Moms have that feeling too. My mom had that feeling about me, and my mom loved me to bits. And you are going to love your son to bits. Do not fear that what you're experiencing right now or the feelings you're working through right now are going to interfere with that love. And you should maybe look at these feelings in a different way. You are working through all of this. You are getting all of this out of your system now so that when you meet your son, when your son is born, you're able to love him. That your grief at not having a girl this time has passed and you are in the clear. You're also pregnant right now, and hormones are crazy, and hormones make people crazy, including men. Our hormones make us crazy too. How many times have I described men on this show as testosterone-soaked dick monsters? Hormones are a wild ride that we are all on. It is a roller coaster that we are all on. And when you're pregnant, you go through some loop-de-loops. That roller coaster can get intense. And you have to be kind to yourself about what you're feeling and try to put it in perspective while still honoring those feelings. It is possible to feel two things at the same time: disappointed that you didn't have a daughter and unconditional love for the son that you did have. My mom did it. My mom did it for me. I know that you can do it for your son too. Just make sure that when your son is 12, 13 years old, they don't find their way to the Savage Lovecast and discover this in the archives. Are you still going to the post office? Still paying full price for postage? Well, thanks to Stamps.com, you don't have to anymore. Mail and ship anytime, anywhere, right from your computer. Send letters, ship packages, and pay less, a lot less, with discounted rates from USPS and UPS and more. Stamps.com saves businesses thousands of hours and tons of money every day, every year. Stamps.com. They bring the services of the U.S. Postal Service and UPS right to your computer. It's a must-have for any business. Whether you're a small office sending invoices, a side hustle Etsy shop shipping out orders, or just navigating this hybrid work life we're all living right now, Stamps.com can handle it all with ease. No wonder over 1 million businesses choose Stamps.com for their mailing and shipping already. Simply use your computer to print official U.S. postage 24/7 for any letter, any package, any class of mail, anywhere you want to send it. Once your mail is ready, just schedule a pickup or drop it off. It's that simple. And with Stamps.com, you get discounts up to 40% off post office rates and up to 66% off UPS shipping rates. Not to mention Stamps.com is a fraction of the cost of those expensive postage meters. Stamps.com really is a no-brainer, one of the great things the internet has brought to us, saving you time and money. It's no wonder nearly 1 million small businesses already use Stamps.com. Join them. Stop wasting time going to the post office. Start saving money. Go to Stamps.com right now. There's no risk. And with my promo code SAVAGE, you get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in SAVAGE. That's Stamps.com, promo code SAVAGE, Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. All right, we're going to take a quick break from your calls to speak with a very special guest. 7 years ago, the journalist Anna Sale created a space to talk about the most difficult subjects all of us avoid or gloss over or minimize or lie to ourselves or other people about. These subjects tend to fall under three broad headings: death, sex, and money. And so that was the name Death, Sex, and Money Sale gave her podcast, which quickly became not just a hit, but a community. She has a new book coming out from Simon & Schuster in May. Let's Talk About Hard Things, which ironically enough was an alternative title for the Savage Lovecast. Hey, Anna Sale, how are you?
Is that right?
No, that's I'm just cool. joking. We talk about hard things a lot on this show, just different hard things.
Yeah, and hard things. Right. Yes, it's true.
Thank you for taking a break from your very thoughtful podcast to come on my very dumb podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. It's really a pleasure.
So the subjects you deal with are often just rough and hard for people to talk about. That's the idea behind the show. And I know that sometimes I read the mail I get and have to take a break, which is code for have an edible. And my stuff tends to just attract like lighter stuff, lighter questions, but sometimes it's heavy and it really affects me. You swim with the heavy all the time. How does it affect you doing the show?
You know, I don't feel this heaviness when I get questions or emails or read stories from listeners, because there's something really incredible about the way I receive it is someone saying, this is going on in my life and I need to talk about it. And I'm wondering if other people are going through this same thing. So it's kind of in this spirit of like building community, and I don't want to be alone. And can you help me not be alone in this? I think it's much harder to talk to somebody about a hard thing when they're not open and willing to talk about a hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my experience has been this incredible, like, just when you say, like, here's the place for all those things that are giving you trouble and are making you feel alienated and lonely and scared and like you don't know where to go. Like, here's the place to send it. And so it feels ultimately good that they have a place to send it, as you know really well, really intimately, I imagine.
Yeah. And it is sometimes weird how people, it's almost like I feel like people call me or they write me a letter because they need to tell someone who isn't in their immediate orbit, their immediate family, isn't the person in their bed, about whatever it is they're feeling, almost as a practice, a trial run. And they're willing to do it on a podcast, in a column, in front of a lot of people who are strangers. And there's something abstract about the readers or the listeners out there, but just getting to say it does seem to help. And maybe that's where we can take comfort, is it can help people unburden.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like people talk to a podcast host, they talk to a bartender, they talk to a therapist. It is practice. And actually, as I was writing the book and trying to apply what I've learned about talking about hard things from doing interviews for a podcast to like actual real life, it is a lot harder. You know, I'm a much better human and a much more generous listener when I'm hosting my show than when I'm, for example, fighting with my husband. I'm a much worse person.
Same. The numbers of times I've had my husband look at me and say, and what would Dan Savage say to you at this moment? Of the three, death, sex, and money, which do you think is the hardest to get people to open up about? And spoiler, my money's on money.
Yeah. I mean, I think it very much depends on where you come from in life and what you're going through in the moment. But I find money is the thing that it seems like we have the least kind of social vocabulary for how to deal with all the feelings that come up. You know, we don't even know if we can talk about dollar amounts with our closest friends and colleagues, you know. And so I think that money can be the most paralyzing. And money is certainly the hardest for me, because that is where all of my hangups are the most ridiculous.
Oh, my God. Mine, too. We have that in common. I find it really difficult to talk about money. You know, there have been times when I was, you know, doing a deal or something for television, and I literally just said, all right, and this is when I leave the room. Because I can't talk about compensation. Huh. So I probably have been undercompensated.
Oh, that's interesting. Does it make you feel like you're going to feel undervalued, or like you're afraid you're going to undersell yourself? Like, what's the anxiety?
You know, my parents were always broke and had four kids. And so money was just always a really tense subject and an unhappy one. And it just, I just get overwhelmed with like crazy unhappy feelings. It's one of the things I love about my husband. He takes care of all of that. I don't ever have to look at anything except April 15th. I sign some tax forms. Otherwise, he's on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
You find sometimes the person who compliments you, the person that you need. But we're not here to talk about me. Here to talk about you. You draw people out on these really difficult subjects. Have you ever had a guest bail or ask you after doing an interview not to run it?
You know, let's see, I'll put those in two categories. I have had someone who kind of like thought he was a public person and he thought he was ready to talk about the pretty paralyzing anxiety that he was dealing with in his life and mental illness. And then in fact, like he didn't feel ready to make that public. Mm-hmm. So that was something where we just said, that's fine. You know, we don't have to use this tape at all. And we wish you the best of luck with your health. Other times, I can remember I did an interview about money with a woman named Sally Krawcheck, who is a former big bank executive who now kind of does a lot of, you know, talking about women's empowerment around money. And I was asking her about her sort of, you know, just life with money and learning about money and what drove her in business. And if it sometimes felt uncomfortable for her to be now kind of coaching women about money when she just had so much more than a lot of women that were in her audience, because she had this, you know, history of being a bank executive. And she did not like that question, like pointing out the success that she had and the financial comfort she had felt like a moral indictment. And so she sort of she bristled. She told me she was pitting out, which I learned is like, I guess, Wall Street bro speak for sweating and being kind of like anxious. And then we talked through it, and it's in the episode about like, wait, what's going on here? And then we sort of unpacked it together. But it was interesting to me that someone whose entire adult life had been about, you know, money, making more money, and now talking to people about how to manage your money, just the fact saying out loud, like, you have a lot of money.
That's really ironic, because the one thing I'm always most uncomfortable talking with people about privately, personally, is sex. I can run my mouth in front of a microphone. I can joke about it in front of an audience. If somebody just like, particularly a relative, starts asking me personal questions about myself, about sex, I kind of just freeze up. Don't want to go there.
Huh. Interesting. Well, that's your right. You know, it's important to have boundaries. You know, they can be different in public and private conversations.
So you have chapters on death, sex, and money, also family and identity. Are those distinct chapters or intersecting? I mean, I've read the book, so I know, but when you carve those out as their own chapters, it's not like family doesn't come up in discussions of money and identity doesn't come up in discussions of sex. Why did they get their own standalone chapters?
You know, I just sort of felt like, for one, like family felt like I wanted to explore like what is so hard about this particular setting for hard conversations. Like it's both the people with whom we have to have hard conversations, because we have to talk about life and death. We grow up, we separate, we figure out whether we have a relationship in adulthood and how close we are. All these things, you know, we have different versions of whether our childhoods were happy. All of that is happening, and I wanted to just like give some space to why is that so hard, and also like allow for to say out loud the reason family conversations are hard is there's this built-in assumption of closeness and shared origin. And so when you do feel separation or isolation from your family, it can feel like you're somehow – it's unnatural, because family is supposed to be close. And I wanted to say like, look – actually, another really natural thing of being a human in this world is growing up, moving away from the sort of maternal, paternal relationship you have with parents, separating. So that separation is also very natural. So you're going to feel this tension between closeness and separation. And that is, if you accept that that is the landscape for family conversations, like you're not either going to feel apart or close, you're going to feel both in confusing ways, then it's, if you accept that that's just what happens in family conversations, then when you notice it, you're like, oh yeah, I'm talking to my sister. This is why this is really charged and hard. It's not something specific to the relationship or something you're doing wrong in family. It's because family has those dynamics.
I wish there was a broader cultural understanding of the way family functions. Like we all get that families are created, you know, people come together and they create a family. There's of time, though, when family comes apart, and it's not because of death, it's because of that moving away and that separating. And it feels so awkward and unnatural and hard and painful, but I think it's more painful than it needs to be because we don't regard it as a natural sort of state or progression, because new families can't form if old families don't
change.
Change, yeah. And in a way end or take a different form.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like parents kind of learn this, like, of course, you're never going to be as close to your child as when, like, for me, like, I had infants who were, you know, drinking from my body, you know, that there is going to be this whole process of raising them is this process of separation. But I think it can be confusing with things like siblings and, you know, figuring out your relationship to your parents as you become an adult. But yes, exactly. I think that, like, you have to move apart to create new family. And also, you know, there's certainly like a lot of space to think about and use the word family for people who you don't share a biological connection and to really honor what those relationships can be. And then, you know, like identity, I just really felt like in 2021 America, I'm writing this book as a white woman. Like, I really felt like to say you're writing a book about talking about hard things and not directly addressing the differences based on, you know, who you are, how you identify, and how you are identified in our society. Like, that felt like a real, like, I just couldn't, that would be a wimpy pass. So I had to have a chapter that just went right at that. How do you talk about difference? How do you talk about racism? How do you talk about, you know, disability, gender dynamics, like all these things? So I wanted to go right at that in a separate chapter.
Anna Sale, creator and host of the Death, Sex, and Money podcast from WNYC. Her new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things, comes out from Simon & Schuster on May 4th. Anna, thank you so much for demeaning yourself by coming on my podcast. I really appreciate it.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you, Dan. Thanks for all you do.
Anna Sale and I continue our conversation on The Magnum, and she helps answer some more of your calls. All on The Magnum, Savage Lovecast, more guests, no ads. SavageLovecast.com to subscribe.
Hey, Dan. I'm calling from Austin, Texas with my sister. We have a really interesting quandary for you. We have an elderly father who has been talking to romance scammers, and he thinks he's going to get a new wife this way, and he's been giving away thousands and thousands of dollars. We have been dealing with this for months and months on end, and there are no legal avenues for us to stop him from doing this, but we're very, very concerned about his well-being. And we had an idea, and I thought you would be the perfect person to ask. If you can tell us how to find an ethical prostitute or an ethical escort to give him some companionship and maybe some sort of physical and emotional support. He's 82 years old. My mother passed away in January, and we need also somebody who can cook. He just wants to be fed and loved. It's an unusual thing, but I have a feeling that this is not something that I feel like there are other people who are probably dealing with this issue. You know, we're both Gen Xers and, you know, he's old and he's lonely and he just wants somebody to give him some love. But I don't want to just go like on Backpage or Craigslist and find random prostitutes. So if you could help us find an ethical person to help him and take care of his needs. I know it sounds a little crazy, but we're just trying to do something to help him get through the last years of his life.
You're looking for two different things here. You're looking for a sex worker who can provide your dad not just with sex. He says he wants a wife. He kind of wants a relationship. He wants that girlfriend experience again. And he can find that if his ego can handle that. You know, if these people who are scammers, what they lead men like your father to believe is that this isn't a transactional relationship, that they are in love with them, that this is about affection, even as they pick their pockets. And the pocket picking can be obvious to us because we're not, you know, the appalled children standing by, we're not blinded by our own egos or our desire for this thing to be true. We're blinded by our own dickful thinking, as your father is probably currently blinded. So if you can appeal to your father's reason and tell him, you know, he's paying a lot right now for the attention of these women and getting really nothing in return. These are transactional relationships that he's engaged in with these scammers online. And he can have a transactional relationship with a sex worker, even sex workers closer to his age, probably in these people who are scamming him online, he can have a transactional relationship with a sex worker that's affectionate, that's mutually respectful, that he actually gets something out of, that he gets some time and attention and affection and touch if that's what he lacks and that's what he wants. But a cook is a different person. That's a different kind of transactional relationship. If you want to hire someone to cook for your dad, put that out there. Find somebody who'll come to your dad's house a couple of days a week, bring groceries and make him a meal and prepare a few other meals to put in the fridge. But that's not a sex worker. And even sex workers who can cook would be insulted to be asked to do that kind of work. And you wouldn't be able to afford a sex worker's hourly rate to make your dad some fucking pork chops. So, got to reason with your dad. Dad, call him dad. You're paying a lot of money and getting nothing, getting used, getting scammed. Let's find an honest, ethical sex worker, someone in her 40s or 50s or 60s, they're out there, who will take your money and give you something in return, give you affection, give you time, give you attention. And you'll be paying for it, yeah, but you'll be getting something. You're paying for it right now and getting nothing but ripped off. And if your dad has the means, you also might want to suggest to him assisted living. He moves into assisted living, moves to a retirement community, there will be people cooking for him. There'll be a whole staff cooking for him. And we've all seen the documentaries about these retirement homes where everybody's getting laid all the time. There are way more women than men. There is a scarcity of men in assisted living. And he will have a lot of potential age-appropriate girlfriends to choose from to get the attention and the affection he wants without having to pay for it. Unless, of course, you count paying for the assisted living facility, which is, of course, prohibitively expensive for most families and most men. But if your dad can swing it, and if he's flushing all this money down the toilet on scammers, maybe he can. If your dad can swing it, moving into an assisted living facility, moving into an old folks home, a retirement community, yeah, that'll be your dad's best bet on the food front and the girlfriend front. Before we get to this week's listener response calls, let's read some of our listener tweets. Allie Muchmore tweets, to the dude in episode 757 of the Savage Lovecast asking about the sensitivity of female anatomy and how, quote, for some women, if you're doing 100% of the shit they want right, it can still take longer than some others to come. Please recommend Emily Nagoski's book, Come As You Are. I recommended Emily's book before. I will again. Everyone should read Emily Nagoski's Come As You Are. And everyone should bear in mind that it takes some people longer than others to come, even when you're doing 100% of the shit they like. And you should never assume that just because you're doing the shit someone likes, you're doing it well or doing it right for them. Always solicit feedback, whatever you're doing. Cecily tweets, this week's Savage Lovecast with the anti-vax pseudoscience head-up-her-ass caller had me screaming at my podcast app. Dan and Dr. Brock setting her straight had me laughing out loud moments later. Anti-vaxxers cannot be reasoned with. They can only be ignored. Sadly, we can't ignore the anti-vaxxers. We didn't. That's why we had Dr. Brock on. We gotta slap them down. And finally, LeanBean65 tweets, thanks for having Dr. Brock on to talk about vaccines. It is so important that we separate fact from fiction and get as many people vaccinated as possible. This ain't over. Indeed, it ain't. Please, if you have not yet been vaccinated and the vaccine is available where you are, go get vaccinated now. All right, thanks to everyone who tweeted about the show this week or posted to your social media. We really appreciate it. And now, your response calls.
Hey, Dan, longtime Magnum subscriber, calling in with a response call for episode 757 for the first caller during the vaccine portion of the show, the vaccine deferrer. First, I'd like to say your opinions and your concerns are valid, and I'd like to apologize on behalf of the people around you who made you feel ostracized. Sounds like you're coming from the right place. There's nothing wrong with seeking out more information, so shame on them. I'd also like to shed some light on the situation and my opinion regarding why at times those anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers are put into this negative box. And like I said, in my opinion, and I know I'm not alone, during this time, these people who are anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers are resisting for the sake of resisting. In their mentality, they are Americans and you can't tell them what to do. And it doesn't matter what you tell them to do, the simple fact that you're telling them they have to do it is why they're resisting. They're not basing anything on science. They're just being stubborn. If at the beginning of the pandemic, you would have told that same group of people that they were not allowed to wear masks instead of that they had to wear masks, I assure you that their group would be called pro-maskers, and they would be just as pissed about the situation. That's just how America is. You can't tell anybody what to do, and they think they're badasses for taking a stand against everything. I think that's where our frustrations come from. It's time for America to swallow their pride and do what's right. This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. And in order for us to be free, we have to be brave. I hope she decides to do the right thing.
Hello, Dan and the team. This is a response to episode 757. I'm the caller who had a question on clit sizes and responses. I loved your answer, but there was just one detail I wanted to flag. When you said the dick is just a very large clit, I realized you were referring to the external clit, but it reminded me of Maisie Hill's work on this. She reminds us the clit is 7 to 12 centimeters in length. Given the fact that the clitoris is in its entirety larger than any average flaccid penis, I prefer to think of a penis as a small clitoris. So I'm calling to propose we refer to dicks as small clits going forward.
Hi, Dan and Savage Lovecast team. I'm calling in response to the caller that is asking why women achieve orgasm in a different time and blah, blah, blah. So I think something that's not mentioned often enough is that how soon and how much I will come also depends on how hot things are in the bedroom. Like, are we connecting? Am I lusting all over you? Are we having a good interaction? Do we know each other? Are we just like really clicking sexually and talking dirty to each other in exactly the way that would get me there? And then the mechanics are important, but that's like, if the sex was just blah and I'm tired and I had a burrito 2 hours ago, there's no amount of clitoral stimulation that may overcome that possibly. So don't forget that the clitoris is also connected to your biggest organ, to your brain and to your emotions and feelings and all that. And that plays part every time you fuck.
And we're going to leave it there. Got a question for me or a comment about this week's show? There are two ways to get them to us. You can call us at 206-302-2064, or you can use the Voice Memo app on your phone to record your question or comment and email it to us at voicemail@savagelovecast.com. If you haven't gotten your tickets yet for Hump's Greatest Hits Volume 3, what are you waiting for? You know you want to watch some of the sexiest, kinkiest, dirtiest, and funniest short films from the first 16 years of the Hump Film Festival. Go to humpfilmfest.com right now to get your tickets. And this Thursday, May 6th at noon Pacific Standard Time, I'll be hosting our first virtual lunchtime get-together for Magnum subscribers. We're calling it Sack Lunch because, of course, we are. It's a live video hangout, again, exclusively for Magnum Savage Lovecast subscribers. We'll talk about this week's Savage Lovecast and whatever else you guys want to talk about. Subscribe to the Magnum version of the show now at savagelovecast.com, and we will send you the link to the show before noon on Thursday. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. Follow Anna Sale on Twitter at Anna Sale. And be sure to pick up a copy of Anna Sale's new book, Let's Talk About Hard Things, which is out. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian, and me and the tech savvy at-risk youth and Nancy will all be back at you next week with another installment of the Savage Lovecast.